Welcome to the Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate Podcast, brought to you by Limitless Estates, where Kyle and Lalita talk to top experts and seasoned passive investors in the business to help provide clarity and key insights to keep you safe on your journey to financial freedom. Our goal is to help you get educated on how to create passive income for you and your family by using real estate as your vehicle. Now here are your hosts, Kyle and Lalita.
Hey everyone, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate Podcast. I'm your co-host Lalita, also joined by Kyle. On the show with us today, we have Bob Trapnell joining us. Bob, happy to have you here. How's it going?
It's going very well, and thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Thanks for being here. Before we get started, here's a little bit about Bob. Bob ventured into real estate in 1991. He specialized in loans, then jumped into buying his first apartment in 1994, which then led to learning about syndications. January 1995 was the start of numerous other properties that were then purchased with his partners and other investors. In 2009, he started buying via syndications and has now completed the purchase of 10 properties totaling 236 units. Bob also has an extensive and extremely impressive athletics background and currently lives in Bend, Oregon. So I know you have a lot of information and knowledge to offer our listeners. So let's dive right in, and could you please tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what you currently do?
Okay, so so I started syndicating back in 1995, and I managed all the properties we bought all over West LA, and because it was locally logistically good for me to manage and run it from home. So I have a good background, which has really been and, you know, part of the education all the way along the way, understanding fixing things and what the costs are and some of the more detailed things. So I just continue to try to find, different ways to invest in real estate. And, it's been a great opportunity and a great run for me.
Awesome.
Perfect. Thanks for that. So you have a unique story because most of our passive guests that we interview actually start out as passive investors and then move into the active role. You, on the other hand, were an active investor and now you're kind of transitioning into a passive investor role. So I want to hear a little bit more about that. So can you take us more into the story of how you made that decision to go actually from active to passive?
So what happened is I did a lot of syndications through about 2006. I was living in the South Bay, and my wife and I decided to move up to Bend, Oregon. And at that point, I still had our buildings in LA, and I had to, let go of the management side. It was the top of the market. We decided we were going to sell them. And so upon the move, I'm in a new market without having the contacts and the things you need to really get going. And I was a little wary of buying anything else at that point. So I kind of sat on the sidelines a little bit from the active side and was trying to figure out, where to go with the market, at the top in 2006. So living up here, eventually what happened is I had met, we were actually up here for 2 years and then the downturn was so bad that we moved back to LA in 2008. And at that point, I actually had met a Marcus and Millichap guy. He was a big producer and turned out I had bought one of his buildings that he had listed way back in 96. And so we kind of connected on the same. From going from an active role, I went to a little bit more of, I'd say, a less of an active role, intermediary, where he kind of took over and we raised money as the co-syndicators, but he ran the show and we still have a lot of the buildings downtown, but that was kind of my last run. And after a couple years down there, my wife wanted to move back to Bend. So we had kept our house. And when we came back here again, I was back to the same dilemma, what do? I can't really do my operations in LA. So, I started trying to find opportunities, any way I could, and networking and just looking at different offerings people had. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just start doing some of the passive investing. And that's kind of the role I got, how I got into that.
Okay, fantastic. So when you're looking for your partners or your syndicators to partner with, and you're going to be on the passive side of that, how are you going about finding them and eventually finding the right one to partner with, especially since you're looking for out-of-state properties? So you're looking probably for syndicators that are located not in the same area that you are.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you know, as you learn being in some of the more expensive markets, the market seasons out, the cap rates get too low, and you start to try to figure out where I get a better return. So, you know, once I was up here, I was looking. And the important thing was you got to continue to networking is probably the most important thing. Networking, talking to people, find operators, look at offerings. The more you can look at, the better. And especially for the people who are more early in the game, I mean, it's so important for them to see many, many different types of deals, because you'll see a lot of different offerings, how they are structured differently, different splits and different back end cuts and fees and everything that comes with these offerings. So really important to just familiarize yourself with the different types of offerings.
Okay. And do you feel it's important to meet your sponsors in person or get to know them at a pretty deep level before you start investing with them? And, you know, how are you building these relationships with these these sponsors?
Well, usually, you know, the answer to that is yes. I would prefer to personally meet the sponsor, but it's not always practical. So, you know, when I can meet in person, that's great. Otherwise, you know, it might start off with some phone calls with questions and answers, and that's going to lead to more questions and answers as you continue to research and dig into who they are and what they're about. Some of the smaller deals, it might be easy because the sponsor may not have a huge amount of investors per deal. So you can probably establish a relationship a little bit easier than, say, you know, if you're going after an institutional type deal. I mean, that's a tough go. You're never going to really get to know who they are. So, you got to keep looking and definitely ask questions and keep trying to talk to them as much as you can.
How often are you talking to your sponsors, other than email, kind of on the phone or meeting them in person after you've already invested with them?
I think up front, you usually have, you know, you're probably going to talk to them, a number of times in the first quarter. And once the reports start coming out, typically quarterly, you find that if things are going well and on expectation levels, that, you know, the phone calls will subside very quickly. The problem always arises when they're not meeting expectations or they're changing their game plan. Everyone starts calling them. It's like, hey, wait a minute, I'm not getting my return, or why are you suspending payments? And, you know, you're not the only one calling. So ideally, the phone calls become minimal as long as everything runs as expected.
Okay, great. And so what are some of the questions you're asking your potential partners? And when I say partners, I mean sponsors, to get their know their character better and to see if they know what they're talking about.
So, yeah, a couple of the big things. One, you know, really want to know what their intent is on the offering. You're trying to match what your game plan is versus the sponsor. So sponsors may tell you typically they have a 5 to 7 year window, you know, it's based on a cash flow, you know, and you want to find out if that intent is really there. I mean, if it's a value, a lot of these deals you're investing are value add deals. That's what you're seeing out there right now. So are they raising the money up front for the value add expenses, or is their intent to take some of the cash flow and roll it back in to the deal, which is really going to probably suspend some of your payments or minimize them for a while? So, you know, the intent to me might be, hey, I'm going to live off my passive income. I want to make sure that the sponsor is going to pay that money out because that's what I'm living on. Or some people may say, hey, you know, I'm investing in my self-directed IRA. I don't care if it's all coming on the back end. You know, the intent is a very important part. And then, you know, probably even more so to ask them about their track record and how they can support the history. So You know, we're really looking, when we talk to the sponsor, we're looking for, is there a conflict of interest on making money for themselves, or is it for the investor? You know, you're looking at the splits. An example maybe would be, you know, the sponsor, this is kind of a funny example, but you pull up and meet them in person, are they driving up in the new Porsche, but you find the deals are only making okay returns, maybe, you know, they're not really meeting the expectations that they're putting in their memorandum. So it's like, well, wait a minute, what's going on here, right? I mean, that's an easy one to see, and I've seen it, you know, I've seen that. So, you know, ask them, have they had any deals gone sour? I mean, they do. And if they do, you know, how do they handle it? You know, I've seen in the past, after say like the 2006 downturn, that sponsors have bitten the bullet and paid their investors back, you know, and they, you know, they've lost money themselves because the relationship was more important than the short-term outlook of like, hey, you know, I lost some money. Because these, you know, if you establish a good track record and have a good history, even if it's okay if you've had a bad deal, because some deals will go bad. And the question is, yeah, how did you handle it? You know, so some of the investors just say, you know what, you're all sophisticated investors, and we all ate this together. You know, so it is good to ask these questions.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great advice. So since you were once an active investor, I'm sure your due diligence process is a lot more in depth than most passive investors. So can you talk to us about how you vet an actual offering?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say really, you know, looking at the numbers. I mean, that's a big thing. So I do my own diligence on things, say like market rents versus what's posted in the memorandum. I mean, when I was doing deals in LA, I would literally, when I got started way back, I would drive around the property and literally write down phone numbers of for rent signs. And I would call them and, you know, I'd ask what the rents are. And more so, people think, oh, what's the rents? Let's compare the rents. But there was more to it back then, because you didn't have the vacancy factor that you have in today's world. There was more vacancy, and so what you had were concessions. And so that was a question asked. I mean, how much is the rent? What kind of amenities are in the place? What kind of concessions are you offering? How big's the unit that you have for rent? Because you really want to compare apples to apples. You know, and then looking at these offerings, you know, are the expenses realistic? And that's going back to kind of my background of being a manager too. You know, I have that experience to know, hey, I got to call a guy to come out. What's this really going to cost? What's the, you know, does this look realistic? So, you know, and then you want to know, are the futures numbers, or are they all based on pro forma, you know, versus what the market is now? Many people base so much of this on, you know, the expected continue rise, right? And it's not always going to rise. At some point, the market tops out. And, you know, what happens if these pro formas are up and up and up and, you know, you can't meet that? So, you know, what's the thing look like if it, say, just kind of goes sideways? So, yeah.
Do you actually go out and fly out to each property that you invest in when you're investing passively?
I do not. I mean, ideally I'd like to, but that's kind of like the sponsored thing. I'm more of a seasoned investor, so I'm much more comfortable not doing that. But I think early on in the game, that probably would behoove people to really maybe consider doing that if they're going to invest.
Yep, I think so, especially if you're going to invest with a sponsor for the first time, because you just never know, right? Even if they have a great track record or, you know, great referrals, it's always good to kind of double check and vet the sponsor in that sense too. You know, go check out the area that they're telling you is a great area.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing better than, you know, seeing it for yourself, because as I've learned, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know, can affect you, so.
Absolutely. So what are some red flags that you've seen from an operator or a specific offering for that matter that's resulted in you not deciding to invest in a deal?
I would say, you know, the first thing I look at is a lack of history. You know, you just never know. I mean, you see in today's game, this market's been ongoing for a long time. And a lot of these newer sponsors, you know, since say 2009 and on, since the markets recovered, have come into the game. How many of them have been through a downturn? You know, everyone looks good on the upswing. The real question is, you know, what happens in the downturn? So, it's back to that, you know, some of them will put out those aggressive assumptions because they, you know, they haven't done the downturn. So you can't always keep going on the appreciation. So, want to look at, maybe the sponsor fees and how they structure them. You know, as far as the investor receiving maybe their preferred return. So, the fees are important too.
When you're looking at that appreciation, what are you looking for? Like, what's maybe something that just sticks out that says, hey, this doesn't look right? I mean, you know, certainly on performance, you're going to see, for the most part, some type of growth year over year. Do you actually look for it flattening out in the back half of the years?
I think this is back to part of the experience level that you have over the years that, you know, everyone's reading right now, we're nearing the end of the market. So if somebody comes out with a new PPM right now and they're having 3% growth a year for the next 10 years, I mean, to me, that doesn't seem like it's going to be realistic. That may have made sense way back in 2009, but you have to be very careful about this growth, and especially when you look at the end and you go, okay, you got this 3% growth, and let's say it goes for 5 years, but they're going to keep squeezing cap rates. And so that you look at the cap rate at the end and what's their expectation on the sale. You know, a lot of smart sponsors, you know, try to do a little bit more conservative or give you say, hey, here's a 6.5, here's a 7.5 cap on a sale. So you've got some different numbers to look at.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't want to look at aggressive all the way from start to finish, especially in today's world.
What's your opinion of the exit cap rate? What are you looking for there?
Definitely market driven. I mean, you know, the LA market, you're buying apartments and things typically are probably averaging, most markets are kind of in that 4.5 cap, you know, so A markets, you know, you could be 2 to 3. And some of the C markets might be, you know, 6, but it's tough to find anything even at a 6. So, you go out of LA and you're going to go into other markets that, you know, people look in the Midwest for that exact reason. Maybe you can find something between 6.5 and 7.5, you know?
Right. But what are you looking for on the sale side of it, on the cap rate when they're projecting the sale in, let's just say, 5 years? Are you looking for a certain rule of thumb there on the increase or decrease of a cap rate versus the market cap when it was purchased?
I would say, like, you know, so for instance, if you're in the Los Angeles market and today's market's at 4.5, you know, you could look at a realistic cap rate to get out and just, I mean, maybe put a 5. I mean, that's okay. I mean, LA is always going to be a tough market. So there's other markets that have vacancy factors and, you know, you may want to look higher kind of in the 7 thing in some other market. If they're putting the PPM out at today's market is 6, I mean, why not have an exit 6, 6.5, 7, you know, as, you know, if you're really getting upside in rent, you're still coming out with money, you know?
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned earlier that it's kind of all about the numbers when you're analyzing and doing your due diligence. So how detailed do you go when they're doing the underwriting? Do you go line by line, every expense item, every income item, when you're taking a look at an offering?
For the most part, yes. I mean, some of this comes down to a little bit of common sense. You know, the numbers are important, are the ones that I mentioned, really the expenses, the fees and the income. And so, you know, I think item by item for sure, but you know, you're looking at the important ones that are really making what's the bottom line you're getting, you know, is there really the cash flow there based on some conservative assumptions, you know, scale it back a little and see what you come up with.
Yep. Okay. And so for those that don't know, what is a PPM and what are some of the top 3 or 4 things that you look at in a PPM that make you feel either comfortable or uncomfortable?
Okay. So a PPM is the short version really of the private placement memorandum. And that is the little booklet or email booklet that comes out from the sponsor that's given to potential investors to review and make an educated decision if they want to invest in a specific offering with the sponsor. So some flags, I really say that, you know, the top two things would be that unrealist pro forma that we talked about, and two, the high unsubstantiated IRRs based on those pro formas, you know, leading to, you know, much of the overall return. So IRRs, internal rate of return. So that if anyone doesn't know what that is, that's the annualized return that the investor gets. So something that would make me feel comfortable, you know, substantiating those comps for both rental and sales prices. Realistic cap rates at the sales price. And the other thing I mentioned was that extensive track record, both in good times and bad, you know, because, you know, these deals in the cycles do go bad. So, you know, you want to find out how they handle those deals. So,
yeah,
that's really what I look at.
How about things like fees? You mentioned that a little bit, but, you know, ultimately, as a passive investor, you probably have a set criteria, whatever that is. Let's just say 15 plus IRR, 8% plus cash on cash. What if you see two different offerings? One is charging, you know, acquisition fee. They have a waterfall structure. They're charging a disposition fee and a refinance fee, and the other one's only charging an acquisition fee, but they're essentially the same returns. Are you leaning towards one or the other? Are the fees something that is going to have you shy away from a deal?
Yes. I mean, I think the answer to that is you see deals that I'm okay with different types of splits, like an 80-20, 75-20, 70-30. Those aren't the things that bother me as much as, you know, if I saw 50-50, I might question it. But the reality is are you getting your returns back before the sponsor's taken a bunch of fees? So it's really important to see where you fit into the sponsor's equation, and you can figure it out by reading this once you've seen deal after deal after deal, you know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So for those getting started in passive investing, would you suggest they have an attorney or a financial advisor look over PPM documents for the first time?
Well, maybe in a progressive state. I would say that really what they should do is look at as many offerings as they can and get familiar with them. You don't want to run to your advisor and your attorney and spend all this money and take their time on every single deal, but get your nuts and bolts, you know, lined up first and really kind of get a good grasp of what you're looking at. And then once you're ready to pull the trigger, then yes, I think that's the time. Okay, I'm ready to put, you know, 50 grand into a deal or 25 or what, on a crowdfunding deal or whatever you're going to do. And yeah, ask your financial advisor for sure.
Yeah. Perfect.
And maybe even for the first couple deals. And once you get more familiar with them, you're going to get a little bit more seasoned, and maybe you don't need to after a while, and ask friends, you know, if anybody else is interested in deals, they can look at them too.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. Lolita's going to take us into our final four questions. Are you ready?
I am ready.
As an apartment investor, you need a website to look professional. Typically, the process of building a professional website can be a real pain, taking thousands of dollars and months of your time. Apartment Investor Pro makes it quick and painless. In fact, you can have your website up and running as soon as today. Go to apartmentinvestorpro.com and use coupon code LIMITLESS to save 10% on your website.
All right, Bob, what is the one tool you use in real estate investing that you cannot do without?
The easy answer to that is my experience, but you know, to go a little bit specific, I'd say, you know, establishing valuations, not an easy for people, you know, for people to always figure out. So what you find out over time is that if you overpay upfront, the deal will most likely underperform your expectations. So, you know, in this business, in the commercial world, what happens is many deals are done off market. That's just the way the commercial world is. And so what you find is that, you know, everyone's come up going, hey, I got this great deal, you know, and you hear it over and over again. And it's like, yeah, we got it off market. I got a great deal. Well, how do you really know it's a great deal? Mm-hmm. And so having, you know, do your own homework, like I was talking about before, by, you know, can you drive? Can you do your own rent comps? Do the ones they have in there look good? Can you actually go check it out? You know, if you're, you know, I actually am a licensed realtor, so it's easy for me to get on the MLS. But in the commercial world, you know, do we have a friend or somebody who can get into CoStar to actually be able to pull real comps and find out, is this really truly the correct numbers? I mean, that's huge to know whether this thing really is, you know, overpriced or not.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Can you tell us a story about your biggest mistake in real estate investing so far and the main takeaway for our listeners?
I can definitely do that. The big story is, and you probably heard this before, if you haven't lost money in real estate, you haven't been in it long enough. Mm-hmm. So back to 2006, you know, I sold our properties and they were in a structure that I was able to do a tax deferred 1031 exchange. And so the dilemma was, where do I put my money knowing that it's the top of the market? And all my friends were like, God, you were so smart. How did you know all these things 2006? You know, and it's like, you know, this is part of the experience, right? My loan background helped also, knowing that the market was likely to crash. So, you know, okay, so, you know, I wasn't very familiar with what's called a TIC, a tenant in common. And I had a buddy do all of this research, and he came to me with a couple of deals, and he said, hey, this company's been around since 1978. Great track record, never lost a dime of anyone's money. And I thought, okay, this looks good. You know, they were institutional deals. I wasn't going to have to do anything because, remember, I was moving. And I thought, okay, I can't manage it. And it turned out that, you know, I didn't find out till later, even with some of the homework I did, that the prices were overpriced. They were told, we have great tenants in here. They're Fortune 500 company type deals. They're never going to default on their leases because they don't want to have a bad record on Wall Street and hurt their stock prices. And, you know, this is the dog and pony show that comes with the big sponsors. And sure enough, the downturn hit. Everyone goes in with the attorneys and they all want to renegotiate their leases, and all of a sudden the property can't service. So, you know, I bought five of them and two of them lost a lot of money, and that was a huge learning curve. Mm-hmm. So they're similar. The DSTs that are out there are very similar. They're great because the TICs and the DSTs were structured so that you could 1031 as an undivided interest and own your share of the property. And so that when they sell them, you can 1031 out, which is great to be able to tax defer your money. But, you know, here there's a lot of these out there right now that you hope that they don't default, because you'll end up in the same. And the worst was trying to get out. You know, you have everybody as their own entity. Well, who's going to represent me? What do I do? You're not just one entity. You're now your own individual. And so the attorneys that came in were all, you know, SEC type attorneys who security attorneys. And so it cost a ton of money to get out, and everyone ends up with next to nothing by the time the deals were done. So anyway, it was a huge learning curve. I would never say I would never do it, but, you know, I'm much more wary of doing something like that again.
Right. All right. What is it that you need to do now to grow your life to the next level?
I would say the big thing is to continue to network. I mean, I continue to grow that network, not only for potential investors for any deals that I make on my own, but for strategic partners that, you know, I still want to invest with people. I love the passive side. It's obviously a lot less work for me, but it's the biggest thing is be diversified. That's the biggest suggestion I could have to people is spread your wealth, be diversified over different properties, different geographical locations, different sponsors, and just, you know, and you know, spread it out. It's the wisest thing you can do.
I couldn't agree more. And finally, where can people find out more about you?
Contact-wise, probably on my email. I don't know if there's any other way they can really find me. So I'm happy to take emails, and then they can, happy to chat with people and educate them and use it as a networking opportunity. So anybody has any questions for me, I'm happy to help them out.
All right. And then what is your email?
Bob Trapp, BobTrap as in Paul, @gmail.com.
Perfect. What an extremely informative interview. Thanks so much for taking us through your journey as an active and now passive investor. And we want to thank you for being on our show.
And I appreciate you having me, and hopefully we'll talk to some people and help them out.
Thanks, awesome. Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about the Passive Income Through Multifamily Real Estate podcast and to get access to today's show notes and to previous shows, visit limitless-estates.com. If you enjoyed this show, please subscribe to the podcast. Thanks again for joining us. Be sure to tune in again next week for another episode.